Kelly ever been ready to hit the hot tubs of the telly. Got my groove on, I twist the line, blended right. Remy XO in my Lexo at the light 3D.
Sucks computer waste gets stuck in landfills or dumped on poor countries.
Where can I take my old hardware?
Freegee!
Is a volunteer nonprofit run by punks like you. Recycling hardware, sharing skills, and providing access to technology.
Check out freegeekvancouver.org or call 604-879-GEEK.
Free Geek! Helping the needy get nerdy!
And welcome to the Pedal Revolutionary Show. It's Thursday. It's always Thursday for us. My name is Ifni. I'll be your host and your sidekick and the bouncer as well, if we get any trouble here in the studio today. I'm pleased to announce that we'll be having lots of visitors today. Pete Lipke is going to be joining us, fresh from the hills of China. And we'll also be talking to the one and only Andy Singer, who is something of an infamous cartoonist. Also today, I'm joined by, of course, my trusty steed, David Ripa. David, how are you today?
Oh, I'm very well, thank you. I'm just a little distracted by my new chair that you've forced me to use.
I know, the torture chair. Well, it's a lot better than the squeaky pimpernel. Sorry.
I don't know.
It's not a bad saddle, but anyway, I'm also joined by one of my oldest friends. His name is...
Still,
I forget.
It's still Clinton.
It's still Clinton?
Yeah.
You're okay with this? Being public about our friendship?
I got to be public about everything, otherwise I get confused.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, I tried to keep secrets once and just all went downhill.
Oh, yeah. So. I hear they don't like secrets in Alberta.
They don't. They also don't like different kinds of beef. I don't,
Really?
Yeah.
So, like, there's a kind of a cow kind of
Well, they're very specific about it. It's like you got to be eating the right kind of beef. But, you know, like, it's all that they serve. So.
So they, like, check up on people and make sure.
Yeah, going to a restaurant is there's so much paperwork these days, it's almost not worth going.
Wow. That's kind of brutal. I mean, we know life is a little bit different over there, but...
Yeah, but the good thing is, though, that every time you wake up in the morning, you leave your house, the first thing that your servant does is hands you a $20 bill, so...
Nice. Yeah, I've heard about the subsidies.
So it's balancing things out, right? You know, you got to do something with the oil money.
You know what? When you toe the line, it's worth it.
I pledge all fealty.
So I'd like to also say to everybody out there enjoying rush hour that you have many wonderful alternatives before you. And whatever you do, just don't get mad. Let's have a day of not getting mad. Everybody, can you feel it? Can you feel the love? It's sunny, right? It's kind of like living on borrowed time. Pete, actually, who is on his way here, shared a really great secret with me. Actually, it's not a secret. And it was passed to him by the fantastic DJ Helmet Hair, who is one of the co-founders of this radio show. And it has to do with water bottles. And I'm sorry to bring it to you so late in the season, but if you are going touring or riding and you want to keep your water bottle cool, you should fill it with water. You can freeze it overnight if you want to, that's fine, but this is another kind of tip. You take a sock and get it wet and actually wrap the water bottle in the sock and take it with you. And it will actually stay cooler a lot longer because the water will evaporate on the surface, keeping the water inside cool.
I find that if you wash the sock before you do this, it's just more pleasant for everybody.
That's true, actually, unless you want to hoard your water. If you want to hoard your water, just take a freshly removed sock and do the process that we just described. Anyway, I'm glad you're here, Clinton. It's nice to see you. It's nice to see you too, David. And so let's get on with things. I just want to announce a couple of... Oh, yeah, sorry, the mic is being a bit weird and my head is a little loose today. I do want to announce a couple of events that are upcoming. Of course, unless you're living under a rock, you will know that tomorrow is Vancouver's monthly Critical Mass Bicycle Ride. That's going to be meeting at the Vancouver Art Gallery, 5:30, and riding at 6 o'clock. That's going to be followed by a Velo Virgo Fusion. This is so hard to say. Velo Virgo Fusion Friday. Oh. and that's going to be, again, after Critical Mass kind of peters out. It'll be at the Anza Club. And it's going to be the birthday kind of Velo Fusion for Amy Conrad, Jen Carey, Tannis, and others for the second annual celebration of summer. Shimmying, and if desired, some mild sousing. And if you come dressed as a virgin. Which, I mean, there are virgin monkeys. You will actually get a discount. The proceeds from that night are going to the Anti-Poverty Coalition. And, of course, they are on the front lines of pushing for housing in the face of the monolith that is the 2010 Vancouver Olympics. We need, like, the sound of crows after that. Ah! In the background. Anyway, also, I would like to mention that there is going to be a Christmas, actually, and it's not Christmas, it's a Christmas. It's on Friday, September the 7th. That is a ride for Chris's. If you are a Chris, join us on the ride. If you're not a Chris but would like to be an honorary Chris for an evening, you can join the ride. If you just want to go for a ride, join us. They seem very emphatic about this riding thing. They are encouraging everyone to wear red, green, and something shiny. Name tags will be provided. That helps. Do you know any Chris's, Clinton?
Two.
Two, hey? Only two? I thought you knew more.
I used to know more, but right. There was the embargo.
Fair enough. The embargo, the sea embargo, which of course has greatly affected Alberta.
It's been really difficult to find help.
I'm so sad. Well, I'm glad that you're here and you made it out. We'll get you all the Christmas you can carry back with you. So if you want to go on that, you need to meet at 7 p.m. at Science World Gazebo. They are departing at 7:15 sharp. And if I know Chris, I know that this ride will actually depart at 7:15. Unlike the slovenly cruise that you will typically see meeting at Science World to go on bike rides, this ride will leave at 7:15. There you have it. There is lots going on in the city. Of course, everybody's trying to get it in before you know what comes down from the sky. So do get out there and look on the internet and send us an email if you have an event that you would like announced. You can always get a hold of us at pedalrevolutionary@gmail.com. Also today, while we're talking, feel free to call in. It's 604-UBC-CITR. And, of course, you are listening to 101.9 FM Vancouver, CITR. Anybody else have anything to add? I didn't think so. Let's play a song. We're going to be playing one of Andy Singer's favorite tunes by a band called, you may know them, their name is spelled ACDC, and this song actually is called Highway to Hell, funnily enough, and there's a bit of a story about where the name came from. The lead singer, who is, of course, from Perth in Western Australia, his local pub was on a highway called Canning Highway, and the pub was at the bottom of a very steep section of the highway, and there was an intersection which saw so many road crashes, it became known as the Highway to Hell. Now, this song came out on an album, and on the cover was one of the band members, Angus Young, who had devil horns and a tail kind of painted on there. And it added fuel to the fire that caused many to believe that the band were all Satanists, which, of course, is not true. We all know that it's car commuters sitting there, one to a car, who are really the Satanists. One piece of trivia, lead singer Bon Scott was actually found dead in the back of a friend's car, and it wasn't karma. He actually, I believe, was alcohol overdose and asthma and hypothermia and a variety of other things that contributed to his early demise. So here we have for you AC/DC, Highway to Hell. Wow. Man, you know, I don't think I've ever sat and actually listened to that song in its entirety, and I'm sorry about all the missed opportunities I didn't take. That was really quite refreshing. And again, you're listening to the Pedal Revolutionary Show. My name is Ifni, and we are being joined today by Andy Singer. Andy, are you there?
I am.
That's fantastic. I'm just going to say a couple of words about who you are for people who might not know. Andy is a freelance cartoonist, and he's been doing it for quite some time now, more than
15 years.
Amazing. How many cartoons do you think that you might have drawn in that time?
Thousands.
Thousands, hey? That's a pretty fair estimate.
At least 2,000, 2,000, 3,000, something like that.
Wow. What's your output like for this kind of stuff?
I do about 150 to 150 a year, about. You could figure out what that is. Times 10, yeah, 1,500, and another 5. Yeah, so it's over 2,000, somewhere between 150 and 200 cartoons a year.
Wow. So if we can get you to speak up just a little bit, I think the line is probably being tapped.
Is that better?
That's fantastic. Ooh.
Okay.
what, did you take the spider off your face, or what did you do?
No, I have, like, one of these phone headsets for being able to work and draw at the same, or talk on the phone and draw at the same time.
Oh, I love it. What's your, is it an office that you call it, or your studio, or what? I mean, I know you're in your
it's
house
the
right
front
now.
Of my apartment.
So what does it look like? Do you have a view? Do you have lots of light
in
there?
Yeah, it looks out on the street. It's an old 1920s brick four-unit apartment building.
Mm.
And they're kind of nice. They've got the sort of arts and crafts thing a little bit. Mm-hmm. It's this neighborhood in St. Paul, Minnesota, that was all built during the 1920s. It's a streetcar neighborhood.
Oh.
So you have certain streets that are zoned for commercial businesses and stuff, and then you'll have 6 to 8 blocks of residential, and then another street that was zoned for commercial. And the commercial streets originally had streetcar lines running mm-hmm. down them.
Oh, wow.
I think Vancouver has some. It was a streetcar city, or parts of it.
Yes, we were, and they were all torn up.
Yeah. Same here. I mean, they 1954, they burned the last of the Twin Cities streetcars.
Did they have a kind of a big, you know, tram burning party? And
there's a famous photograph when I do slide talks of these two basically gangsters, one of whom was in city government. I think he was a councilman. And the other one was a National City Lines attorney who was brought in to, you know, help the Twin Cities Rapid Transit convert to buses, of course, GM buses.
Mm-hmm.
And they basically sold off the trolleys that they could to Mexico and then burned the rest. And there's this famous photograph of the two of these guys, him getting a huge check, like Publishers Clearinghouse kind of check, from the city councilman. And it's raining, and the last of the streetcars are burning behind them. And it's classic. It should be on, like, a punk album or something.
Wow. Well, you know, there's still time.
Yeah. You know a band that's looking for an album cover?
I know a movement that's looking for an album cover.
Okay. All right.
Well, yeah, and we had the same kind of thing happen with our streetcars as far as having them torn up. You still can see some of the cobblestone streets. We do have one tram car left that runs. It's a very short kind of tourist run to one of our – it's a little island called Granville Island, and it's a shopping area that's been reclaimed from an industrial dump, essentially. But the tram car was violated. Some folks went in at night and pulled all the copper wiring off the front and sold it for, you know, something probably approaching $50, but worth, you know, tens of thousands of dollars of damage. But you know what? Hard times, Andy.
Yeah, I mean, we're headed towards Iraq, where people are stealing the copper out of, like, electrical wiring and mm-hmm. plumbing and stuff like that.
Got to fund the war effort.
Yeah, you know, or fund or whatever.
Everybody tighten your belts, right?
Yeah.
There's been some, we've had some guests on previously, and we've talked a little bit about the idea of reducing consumption and victory gardens and things like that, and how we're getting back to that kind of mentality that was only undertaken during intense wartime. And even though the war, I think, isn't really part of people's consciousness necessarily, but there is certainly a very strong forces that are threatening our quote unquote, like, our way of life.
We're reaching planetary limits, and I think no one really wants to acknowledge that. But you know, you're seeing copper prices and aluminum prices and all these things, oil prices go up, and you know, the whole Hubble curve peak oil phenomenon, which now even like Wall Street accepts as reality. Dictates that at some point, and I think we're reaching that point, demand is outstripping supply.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, eventually supply is actually going to decline. And we may have already reached that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah, like, life as we know it is not sustainable.
How far do you think we should go to stop things that we know are destroying the habitat?
I think we need to radically, I think if we radically address it now as nations, Canada and the U.S. and other places, even just internally in terms of our own policies of urban planning and development and stuff like that, it'll make the landing a lot softer. But unfortunately, because no one wants to address it until it's an emergency, I think the landing is going to be really hard.
What do you think CEOs dream about at night?
It probably depends on the CEO.
Well, let's say in the car industry.
I have no idea. They dream about making money. Although I'll give it to the CEOs in Japan, at least have been managing their car corporations better than in the United States, in the sense of looking at where resources and need is headed in the long term.
Mm-hmm. They've had to look at high priced oil for quite some time.
Right. But they've always, and I guess as a result, twice now, I feel like in the United States we're reliving the 70s where, the Japanese were making small, more efficient cars, and U.S. car companies had been lobbying Congress and the U.S. government to avoid having any CAFE standards or regulations imposed on them. And they were the ultimate victims of their own effort to not regulate themselves, if you know what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's kind of exciting too because it is very retro, and we're starting to go further back where we're talking about using coal as a source of energy, and that's really exciting stuff.
Yeah.
The possibilities are kind of boggling. I was reading an article in one of our local alternative newspapers called The Republic of East Vancouver, and they were talking about our neighboring province, Alberta, and we're joined with a Confederate from Alberta, from that province today. The article describes a new technique for extraction of oil. They have all these little oil pockets that are kind of in solid coal. It's kind of like Swiss cheese. So they've been trying to figure out a way to get it out, so they actually did it. They used something very cutting edge. It's called TNT. And what they do is they drill down, 200 or 300 feet, and then they go at an angle, and they slide TNT down there, and they do these big blasts. And what it does is it shocks the bubbles so that they can actually come up into a well. Now, the problem is that it's destroying the aquifers and underground river systems as well, so you're getting huge swaths of former grassland that were used for grazing cattle, and beef is also a big industry there, but they're no longer useful, and in fact they won't be ever useful again. Everything's dried up, and also there are some farms in the area, and family farms wells are so poisoned, some of them actually the water bursts into flames.
Yeah, they have, in the Midwest of the United States, coal bed methane is big, which also involves pumping water that's underground out of it, basically spilling it on the ground to get at, methane underground. And the quantities of these things that they're getting, in the process that you're describing in coal bed methane, are incredibly small. I mean, they would supply America or Canada's oil needs for about 8 minutes, And meanwhile, they reduce a piece of land to a dehydrated, useless nothing.
Mm-hmm. It's really a strange economy of scale, isn't it? I mean, you look at biofuels and you look at the amount of resources and energy that need to go into growing enough corn to fuel or to turn into fuel, and ultimately, of course, that those nutrients that the corn had produced never go back into that soil, so the soil becomes exhausted. The cars that are trying to run on this and the machinery that tries to run on this, it's extremely inefficient, because, of course, the great thing about oil is that it's been fermenting for millions of years. It's extremely, compacted, but anyway.
No, it's nuts. I mean, I think that to bring it back to bicycles, the linchpin is, for a lot of this, is transportation, and I feel like the big thing is trying to stop sprawl, and that's definitely been the focus of what I've been interested in alternative transport. I mean, I'm a car-free person, and I love bicycles, but, my main thing is, stop the sprawl, because the more you make these incredibly spread-out car-oriented communities, the more people have to travel, and you need to, get rid of the lifestyle. It's not a question of whether it runs on ethanol or gas. It's a question of the entire lifestyle, and spread outness of human dwelling is in unsustainable. So making more bikeable, walkable communities.
Wow,
is definitely like and you look at the transportation sector in both the United States and I'm guessing in Canada as well, mm-hmm. is the major contributor of global warming gas. It's the major contributor of particulate air pollution in urban areas. You're seeing, yeah. I know, Toronto in Canada, but like here, there's 200 cities which are EPA non-attainment areas for air quality.
EPA non-attainment areas.
Yeah, the Environmental Protection Agency set air quality standards mm-hmm. back in the 70s, and basically 200 U.S. cities or metro areas, you know, I didn't even know we had 200, mm-hmm. but I'm taking an environmental law course, and they are non-attainment areas for air quality, meaning that a significant enough amount of time during the year, I don't know if you have these in Vancouver, but we have in the Twin Cities air quality warning days.
Mm-hmm. They have them in Toronto. Do we have them here in Vancouver? I've never heard of us having actually one go into effect.
I don't believe so.
You've got a
I think when you're closer to the coast, or it can, you know, mm-hmm. although the Bay Area, which is San Francisco Bay Area, which is close to the coast, has terrible smog.
We just started getting the air quality warnings this year in Edmonton. It's been exciting.
Yeah. Really? How's it going over there with that?
Well, that's fine. If
people
you don't
excited?
Mind breathing.
Yeah. Yeah, you're not supposed to do strenuous exercise. And the thing is about these air quality warnings and this air quality issue, is, and I bet this is the case in Edmonton too, in the Twin Cities, it's not industry because most of the heavy industry has moved over to China or wherever. It's all cars. You know, it's all automobiles. And, you know, the regulatory agencies in the United States and, of course, legislators within the states where this is going on don't want to put their foot down and say, oh, we're not going to allow another highway to be built in this metro area because the air quality is already so bad. Mm-hmm. You know, or, and they just keep building roads.
We're in the midst of fighting a highway expansion here in Vancouver as well. And if anybody's interested in seeing information about that, go to gatewaysucks.org. You can find information. And also, we should mention Andy has a website. It's www.andysinger.com. You can also go to the Pedal Revolutionary blog. There's a couple of cartoons up there as well. That's pedalrev.blogspot.com. And if anybody has any questions out there, please give us a call. It's 604-UBC-CITR. There we go. I did my job. So what do you think we need to be doing?
My big thing with the car, you know, fighting these highway projects, and I'm guessing this, I just had communication with some guy in Saskatchewan. But I was reading about a $5 billion transportation bill or bond or something for that, most of which was going to roadways. So I'm guessing Canada is the same problem. And that is that there are funding structures which are set up in the United States at the state level. They're state fuel taxes and state tolls that were set up in the 1920s and 30s, largely under the influence of General Motors. Mm-hmm. And they mandate, often in Minnesota, it's written into the Minnesota state constitution that fuel taxes have to be spent on highways. So if you wanted to change that and spend the money on public transit or on bikeways or anything else, you would have to amend the state constitution, which
wow.
requires 2/3 of the public to vote, you know, in favor. I mean, it's a big deal. Hmm. You know, the constitution doesn't get amended that often. Mm-hmm. And this is true in a lot of states. I would say, like, you know, definitely the majority of states in the United States, and some of them have much more draconian things. I think in Alabama, there is a rule in the state constitution that the state cannot subsidize public transit at all. You know, this was written into, I forget what it's called, it's like Amendment 69 or something. Public Radio did a feature about it and a group that's trying to fight to have it overturned.
Hmm.
But so you have these amendments in states all over the U.S., and as a result, you have these funding sources, the fuel tax or, in some cases, toll revenues, which are dedicated to highway spending. So you've created this enormous pool of money that can only be spent on highways. And so you have state DOTs or highway agencies.
Departments of Transportation, yeah.
And they will always find a solution to a transportation problem that involves building freeways because they know it can be funded.
Absolutely.
You know, I think that an important thing for people to realize, in the United States, they, in early 90s, or actually 1989, they passed a piece of federal legislation that allowed a portion of federal gas taxes to be spent on non-automotive projects. It was called ICE-T, was the acronym for it. And it gets renewed every 6 years and unfortunately whittled away at by the highway lobby. But it's paid for a lot of light rail systems, for a ton of bike trails and stuff in the United States, and they need to do the same thing on the state level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, basically enact versions of this thing in Minnesota, in California. You know, and then I think that you would start to see a real change in policy.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is that you have these state and, in some cases, federal agencies, and all people think that politicians run government, and they don't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, ever since FDR in the 30s and big, you know, government, the creation of big government agencies, agencies basically run government because the civil servants who manage them are there for life unless they do something corrupt. Whereas politicians kind of come and go.
You mean unless they do something corrupt and get caught, but please continue.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, for example, a highway agency and it, you know, a state university system, anything, I mean, its goal is to grow. You know, if you become chancellor of a state university system or you become a head of a highway agency, your job is to get as much money and jobs and cash flow and to grow your agency if at all possible. And in the U.S. right now, there's a problem, and I think in other places, with the reason the bridge collapsed in Minnesota was because MnDOT, who's the state highway agency, spends 3.5 times more money on expansion than it does on maintenance and operations.
Really?
And so, you know, if you're an agency, you want to grow. That's what you want to naturally do. It's not like a conspiracy. It's just, mm-hmm. you know, you're not going to become chancellor of a university or head of a major agency unless you're good at getting, you know, government to write checks to you, unless you're good at structuring laws and stuff to finance, getting dedicated financing for your agency. And I think that activists need to address that political issue if they want to see major changes in transportation.
And the challenge, too, is that in order to address those types of things, it's really hard not to become ensnared in a bureaucratic process because that can be soul-sucking.
Yeah, it can be, but at the same time, like, you know, the political system is whack and it's broken in many respects, but it's all we have.
Mm.
You know, and I think that, you know, when people do... you know, I think here I've seen a lot of improvement in bike amenities, for example, in the Twin Cities or in other places, and it's because activists went to freaking meetings and,
mm-hmm.
like, you know, sat through all the BS of you know, making stuff happen politically.
Mm-hmm. And I totally agree. I guess I come from the direction that I think that municipal action is a lot easier to put into effect and to see direct results and to have success and morale kind of on an up spiral, but getting into things on a federal level can take much, much longer. And it seems like a lot of municipalities in many countries around the world are starting to just kind of take their own fate into their own hands. And, you know, cities are starting to, for example, adopt the Kyoto Protocol when their national governments are refusing to. And I guess...
I hear you. I mean, I agree with what you're saying, and I think, like, yeah, the local level's the best to start at, but at the same time, you know, the reason, say, you guys are fighting a freeway or we're fighting freeways here in the Twin Cities is that even though none of the local politicians are in favor of them, the state politicians and this major state agency who basically has the state politicians in their pocket is in favor of it because it wants to grow. And to give you an example, like a highway agency, I'll give you examples of ways in which, even at the local level, you probably have a local public works department in Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
And the local public works department is often the conduit for state and federal highway dollars. You know, they come up with projects and propose them to the state or to the federal government, and they get approved and get funded. And so often the directors of the local public works departments are highway happy because, you know, they also want to grow their little public works agencies and they want projects and stuff for people to build. And there's this huge pot of money, once again. And they will do things like in St. Paul, we have a public works department that these two guys, Bruce Brees and John Masco, run, who are nice enough people, but they find a highway solution to every problem, and they, you know, they will
build your way out of congestion.
Right, and they know possibly in their heart of hearts that these solutions aren't very good, But they will do things like behind the scenes politically. They will go to the Midway Chamber of Commerce, or they'll go to the St. Paul Chamber of Commerce with like an expensive $30,000 PowerPoint presentation made at, you know, public expense, and convince members of the Chamber of Commerce or convince various public politicians behind the scenes that, oh, they need to let us build this road. Or a highway agency will do other things, such as they have things called legal retainers. And a legal retainer is what a corporation or a city council or a highway agency pays. It's a fee that they pay to an attorney to basically have them on call. Mm-hmm. So that if they ever want consultation on something, they can call up that person, and that person has to do work for them. So there are many people who get many – most politicians are lawyers, and – there are many people who get legal retainers, but they don't actually do any work for the person giving them the retainer.
They just sit in their lair and wait.
Right, or they don't even sit in the lair and wait, but it's just essentially a way to pay legalized bribes. And, you know, it's a way to, you know, or there was a guy, Mark Arata, who used to be in the Minnesota legislature, who would introduce legislation on behalf of MnDOT, our Department of Transportation. And he worked in the private capacity for a contracting firm that did $10 million with the MnDOT contracts. You know, so behind the scenes, and to get another example to give you scale, like, you know, 1 year, I think it was 2003 or 2004, the MnDOT had a $5 billion budget in a state that only spends, total state spending, $27 billion. So you have one agency that's spending a fifth of state spending. Most of it's coming from dedicated funds, so it doesn't even pass through politicians' hands or the legislature. And it's just unbelievable political power.
Yeah.
And so I think that, you know, while we do stuff locally, and that's good, and recognize, say, locally with our own public works departments that these kind of things can be going on, we need to also look at, okay, what are the revenue streams that we're setting up at a state level or a federal level, and, you know, use our local politicians maybe that we've gotten elected to pick on the state representatives or people to say we need to change this.
Mm-hmm. So you said that you're studying environmental law. It sounds like you have big plans to get in the fray.
There's no money in it. I'm studying it just to have some other income source with health insurance besides drawing cartoons.
Right on. That's as good a reason as any.
But I like environmental law. Unfortunately, environmental law on some level is as broken as, as government.
Because probably a lot of those folks are working for companies that are trying to fight judgments that have been passed not in their favor.
Right, exactly.
Hmm. Do you consider yourself a radical?
Not really. I mean, I just think that I consider myself, just common sense. I mean, sometimes I think of myself as conservative.
Because as far as
conservation
goes,
of energy and conservation of land and conservation of resources.
Yeah. How do you think people perceive you in that sense? Do you think that you're perceived as someone who's on the fringes, or because of the shift and the increase in bike culture, do you think that you're starting to move into a more middle position?
It's hard to say. I mean, I would say that I've alienated a lot of local politicians who are from the Democratic Party here.
Through your cartoons or just through your
speaking? I'm involved politically. I mean, I go to, like, you know, coffees, and I go to the legislature occasionally to try to, like, they have days where you can go yak with your legislator.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely got to the point where my state senator and my state representative were like, here comes that wacko anti-car guy into my office. And I'm not sure whether it makes them nervous because they are they know what's going on politically, or if they just I don't know what goes on in their heads, you know. But at the same time, like, locally, there's a guy, Russ Stark, who we're hoping to get elected to city council. It looks like he is going to get elected, who's a car-free guy, and who's very smart. He's been on the what are called TMOs here, transit management organizations, and he's been on the University Avenue TMO for, like, 10 years, and is really hip on a lot of these issues. You never know. Maybe he'll become mayor, down the road or something, or go to higher office.
What kind of feedback do you get from people? Like, what kind of emails do you get? I was when I sent you an email to contact you about the show, I was imagining, like, what kind of feedback does Andy Singer actually get from you? Do you get angry letters? Do you get
I get people who are real psyched. You know, I would say mostly positive, but then a lot of the publications that I'm in at the moment are somewhat preaching to the choir publications. Mm. I get, in places where I'm on more mainstream things, I ran in the local daily paper here 5 days a week for about a year and a half, and then I got, it was a much more mainstream audience, and I would say I got, not that much, but occasional pieces of hate mail.
Hmm. I wanted to ask you as well who you like and who you consider radical.
In terms of bikes or politics?
In terms of Andy Singer.
I don't know. I mean, I love Ivan Illich, the author.
Mm, yeah.
On many different dimensions. I recommend to everyone to read the book Energy and Equity, which Ivan Illich put together in the early 70s.
Can you tell folks who might not know who he is a little bit about him?
He was actually a priest, a Roman Catholic priest who got sent down to Mexico and gradually became aware of the negative impact that technology and Western culture was having on Latin America. And he wrote a series of social science books that are amazing, all of which have a very similar theme, and the theme is that there is an optimal level of technology or an optimal level of specialization. And when you go past that point or past that level, you start to become inefficient and non-sustainable as a society. And so he did one book on transportation that's called Energy and Equity, in which he sort of maintains that the optimal speed for human relations is the speed of a bicycle, and that once the society starts to go faster than that, the whole society is paying for incremental increases in speed of the elite, so that, the overall society is paying in terms of oil consumption, et cetera, so that a minority of people can travel it in jet aircraft at 600 miles an hour. I'll give a quote. Here's a quote from Ivan Illich that I love. Mm-hmm. I always read this, but...
Do it. We're ready.
Ivan Illich, and he says, quote, "The typical American male devotes more than 1,600 hours a year to his car. He sits in it while it goes and while it stands idling. He parks it and searches for it. He earns the money to put down on it and to meet the monthly installments. He works to pay for petrol, tolls, insurance, taxes, and tickets. He spends 4 of his 16 waking hours on the road or gathering resources for it. The model American puts in 1,600 hours to get 7,500 miles, less than 5 miles an hour." So, the point is, if you add up all the time that you spend in your car, like earning money to make car payments and gas and tolls and insurance and tickets and everything else, and you add up all that time and, divide it into how many miles you've actually traveled during that year, you'll find that you haven't actually traveled that far or that you haven't traveled that fast.
And what's interesting, too, is that when people are accustomed to using a car as transportation, their range actually increases. So they'll live farther away from where they work, and they'll live farther away from where they have to get food, and they'll...
Which is what creates sprawl.
Exactly.
Cars create a certain type of development which is only negotiable by car. Mm-hmm. Because they need room for parking, they need room for maneuvering. The car's destruction of space is perhaps its biggest polluting quality, which, just because you put ethanol or something in the gas tank, you're not going to get at this destruction of space.
When do you think it's going to start hitting home with people? I wonder sometimes about the general consciousness of what, of, for example, peak oil or habitat destruction, like human habitat destruction. And I wonder when we're actually going to turn a corner, and the people who at this point are they telling themselves that we'll be okay with hybrids, or are they telling themselves that it's actually not true and not happening? Or,
well, I think it's even hard to convince people to go to hybrids. I feel like there's this major push by people in the United States, which I applaud and try to be part of, which is that you know, we need to, you know, the Al Gore movie, National Public Radio in the United States is doing a series where every week they have a feature on global climate change. I mean, there's just all these different people trying to, like, simultaneously make this push for awareness.
Mm-hmm.
To try to get the U.S. to, you know, sign on to the what will eventually be the successor to Kyoto, not that Kyoto was that effective.
And I think what's really interesting, too, is that, you know, we can talk as much as we want about these very big, very important, very scary things that are happening, but for someone to see a cartoon that kind of wraps it up into something that they can relate to very immediately is very useful.
Yeah, I like cartooning as a piece of agitation propaganda. I think, like, if you go into restaurants often in the United States, they have to have, like, a poster on how to give the Heimlich maneuver to people when they're choking. And it's a cartoon, you know, or if you're on the plane and they're showing you, like, how to put on the breathing apparatus or whatever, your life vest, it's a cartoon.
Mm-hmm.
When we were trying to train the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, they gave them, like, comic books, the CIA, you know. Because it is this great communication tool with people.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me of the poster for it came out during the Second World War, and it's a photo. It's a drawing of a car, and there's a guy in a kind of a fedora hat and a suit driving it, and in this passenger seat is a ghostly figurine, and the caption says, "If you ride alone, you ride with Hitler."
Right. Yeah.
And while we're on the topic, you gave a quote, so I get to give a quote. I'm going to quote Adolf Hitler. He said that the victor will never be asked if he told the truth.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, totally. I mean, the victors write history.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
So we need, as far as outreach goes, we need a critical mass flyer for drivers. Do you have one?
I don't have one per se, but I mean, I basically give out my cartoons free for anti-car stuff, or like any group that's doing, like, you know, nonprofit anti-car or pro bike, you know, work or trying to raise awareness or stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of those,
I got a lot of requests from people for that.
A lot of those can be found on your website. Are there other good repositories where people can find your work?
They can find it. I mean, you can. I have a book called Cartoons that you can get off my website, and I have a CD-ROM that goes with it, and it has all of my transportation cartoons, basically on the CD in high-res TIFF format. So they could get that and basically have every transportation cartoon I have.
Wow. Well, I've got the book in my hand, but I didn't know there was a CD-ROM. I borrowed it from actually the founders of this radio show, and they had a bicycle wedding, and I understand that you had a bicycle wedding too.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
How was that?
I think it's fun when you decide that you want to be car-free. As a friend of mine, Ken, says, it's kind of like you're unplugged from the Matrix a little bit,
mm-hmm.
and you see intersections, and you see your city, and you see city planning in a whole different way, because you're seeing it from a bicycle or pedestrian point of view. And, like things that don't, that your city council can't figure out, like why a certain section of town is so dead. Like when you're on a bike, you're like, oh, the reason it's dead is because there's a huge freeway between, you know, residential neighborhood and the, you know, that part of downtown or something. I mean, you see things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you also see certain rituals like weddings or funerals where, you know, you have these huge vehicle processions of cars that it's like, why do we have that? You know? And, you know, why can't we should have like a bicycle powered funeral company, or, you know, bicycle powered wedding company, mm-hmm. or something, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, I know too, when people make a transition into a car free lifestyle, they become more interdependent with the people around them oftentimes. And, for example, in Portland, they have if you want to move, you just kind of send an email to this, kind of network of people, and everybody comes with their bike trailers and they help you move your house.
Uh-huh. Car-free. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
It's kind of nice.
I've seen that in the Twin Cities too.
Hmm. So if you do get the inclination to make a critical mass flyer for drivers, leave a space so that everybody in every city can write in, critical mass meets at this place at this time.
Well, like I say, you know, you're welcome to, like, if there's a particular cartoon you want or whatever, I can, you know, through the technology of email, I can send that. So, but, I've always thought, like, they have these fundamentalist Christian groups. I don't know if you have this in Vancouver, but we'll often pass out these little comic books.
Oh, yeah, I've seen those.
That were made by Jack Chick.
Yes.
You know, and they'll, you know,
classic.
They're horribly racist and
frightening.
frightening. But, like I think it would be very cool to have the same thing with, like, you know, information and comics
yeah.
about different environmental issues where we're, like, passing those things out to people or drivers or whoever, you know, that are equally cheap to produce, you know.
Andy, that's a great idea.
Yeah.
Are you going to do it? I don't have time. You do it.
Yeah.
You're much more talented than me.
There you go.
Cool.
Yeah, I'm full of suggestions. Which is bad.
So if anybody out there would like to produce some little chapbooks.
Environmental flyers. You could become the Jack Chick of environmentalism.
Oh, yeah, I love it. And I want to ask you, I think we need to think of a term to describe people in single occupants in cars who are commuting every day. What do we call them? Because it's so long. It's like single occupant car commuters. And we can't just call them, like, child-eating, evil...
Singlots or something.
Yeah, you know, aliens from outer space invasion. So
it's a singlot.
Oh, singlot's pretty good.
I'm not sure Austin mulled that one over.
Okay, fair enough. Well, listen, it's been a real pleasure talking with you, Andy. And we are going to play a song that you probably may not have heard before. And thank you again for dropping by to see us. And come by our Critical Mass sometime.
Cool. Take care. Thanks for having me on the show.
You're very welcome. We're going to go to a song now by a woman named Heather Love. She's from New York City, and it's a song called If Cars.
When you buy a car, do you realize your money pays for things that you probably despise, like oil spills covering Alaskan land, cash in a crooked politician's hand, children dead on desert sand. So wouldn't it be nice if cars were banned? Wouldn't it be nice if cars were banned? Trees could grow upon the land, no more smog up in the sky. Let's make it happen by and by. Wouldn't it be great if streets were quiet? No car horns and engines making a riot. Think of all the time you spend in traffic jams. Wouldn't it be great if they were banned? Think of all the tax money that you owe to pay for wildland to be covered up with road and for hospitals for people hit by cars. Wouldn't it be great if they were barred? Wouldn't it be nice if cars were banned? Trees could grow upon the land. No more smog up in the sky. Let's make it happen by and by. Cars give us jobs, you may say. They're just the good old American way. But GM doesn't care about American jobs. They send them where they're cheaper, the greedy slobs. Imagine if kids could play without fear. The drivers would hit them while drinking beer. And if you weren't stuck inside a metal cage, running people down with your road rage. Wouldn't it be nice if cars were banned? Trees could grow upon the land. No more smog up in the sky. Let's make it happen by and by. Oil companies don't seem to care if they poison the water or pollute the air. If you're in Nigeria and mention that, they're gonna execute you in no time flat. We're drilling Alaskan wilderness so gallons can be 5 cents less. And the Saudi royals got rich quick and inspired terrorist lunatics. Wouldn't it be nice if cars were banned? Trees could grow upon the land. No more smog up in the sky. Let's make it happen by and by. Greenhouse gases fill the sky. 40,000 people each year get hit by cars and die. None of those problems would be there if people had cars that they would share. If buses, trains, and bikes were everywhere, this song could go on without any end. Till you realize that your car is not your friend. We're all car addicts, let's just say no. Then those cars will have to go. Wouldn't it be nice if cars were banned? Trees could grow upon the land. No more smog up in the sky. Let's make it happen by and by. We can change things, watch and see. We will have to eventually. So let's get together, we'll work all day to make those cars go away. Won't it be nice when cars are banned? Trees can grow upon the land. No more smog up in the sky. It's gonna have to happen by and by.
Yay!
On the last Friday of the month, the territorial mating call of the indigenous local cyclist is heard echoing through downtown Vancouver. Thousands of cyclists have once again reclaimed the streets and scared belligerent motorists. But now, you wonder what is next. The night is still young, and you're feeling a little frisky. After all, there are only so many car tires you can peel in a day. Well, we have the solution. Velofusion Bicycle Dance Party. Burlesque, bands, dancing, DJs, and pirated movies. The last Friday of the month after Critical Mass. Come one, come all for a little primal rowdiness. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. The Answer Club.
I like that lone coyote in the background. Yes, you have been listening to the Pedal Revolutionary Show, 101.9 FM. That was Andy Singer. And again, you can go and find information about him at www.andysinger.com. Great guy. Send him some love mail. We actually have in the studio with us another person from far away. It's Pete Lipke, or as I like to call him, Plipke. How you doing, Plipke?
I'm doing pretty good.
And you are just on a hiatus in Canada from abroad.
That's right. I was in China for about 3.5 months, and I'm just back here for a short time, and then I'm heading back for another 5 months.
What are you doing out there?
I'm studying Chinese, since, Chinese is one of the more prevalent languages in Vancouver. I figured it'd be good if I could, speak it.
And happily, it's one of the more prevalent languages in China as well. So how do you say bicycle in Chinese?
Zixingche.
Say it again.
Zixingche.
Zixingche.
Sort of.
Yeah, come on. Well, that's do you know any other cycling related words that we should be equipped with?
How about danxin? That means watch out.
Nice. Danxin. Very cool. Okay. And so what's the cycling like over there? Where are you living? Are you living in a kind of a smaller area?
It's kind of smaller. It's the city of 3 million people. It's called Hangzhou, and it's about 180k outside Shanghai. And it's basically like critical mass every day, all the time.
Nice. That doesn't sound so bad.
There's a little bit of style difference between Shanghai and Hangzhou. In Shanghai, there's some streets that are car only, and that's taken over by all sorts of expensive Mercedes and whatnot. And then every other street basically is owned by bikes and electric scooters. So the cars make their way through when they can, but they basically weave around all the bikes. And any time you get a stoplight, then you instantly get, 20, 30, 40, 50 bikes lined up there ready to go.
That's really hot.
So that's Shanghai. It's kind of anything goes. And then when you get to Hangzhou, they did a little bit more separation. So on a major road, the cars will have the middle two lanes, and then the bikes will have a full lane on either side. So when you're riding down the road, you have this full lane for all these bikes and electric scooters and whatever, and there's a cement divider in between the bikes and the cars. So it's a little bit more orderly that way, but there's still a lot of bikes on the road.
Hmm, nice.
So, a little strange getting back to Vancouver, where I get this little tiny space, and the cars zoom by, and their mirrors kind of whistle past my ear, and they don't know how to move over or give space, and they own the lane. And in China, it's just bikes own the lane, and cars, kind of weave around them.
Hmm. It's kind of like music, that whizzing by your ear thing. It's got a certain, when you get a couple of them on, a bit of windy music.
It's not music to my ears.
Yeah. It's not music to your ears. Fair enough. Well, it's nice to have you here in town temporarily, and anything else that we should know about? What kind of bikes are they riding out there? They're like single speeds.
It's everything.
Really?
There's a lot of sort of used. I mean, since so many people have so little money, then everything from rusty old used bikes with actually a lot of the steel is really low quality. You leave it out. I got a bike there really cheap, and I left it outside for maybe a week and a half, and it's all rusty.
It's all gone now.
Yeah, it's mostly gone. Yeah. There's a lot of used bikes. There's some fancy bikes. There's those superheroes on the road. Mm-hmm. They got their spandex and the bright colors on.
They have those.
They have superheroes there.
Do they have global warming too?
Yes, and lots of smog.
Okay, just checking.
So there's everything from, Joe Blow on a rusty old whatever, I don't know how old of a bike, and then up to the superheroes on their fancy bikes. But it's mostly, old used bikes, a lot of single speeds, anything that rides is on the mm-hmm. road, and there's lots of bike shops all around that'll fix up anything into a moving bike.
Nice. There's something that rolls. And not only is it that they may not have a lot of money, but also they're practicing the time-honored art of conservation. Yay.
That's right.
Right on. Well, listen, everybody, thank you so much for joining us. We will be back in a couple of weeks. Again, this was the Pedal Revolutionary Radio Show, and we are going to go straight on to the next show, I guess. We're not going to play any of the okay. So, like I said, my name is Ifni. It's been my pleasure, not yours. And why don't you send us an email with feedback or tell us to piss up a rope. It's pedalrevolutionary@gmail.com. And enjoy the sunshine. Don't go inside unless you're paid to.
Listen, radio is an important means of communicating 3,000 years of habit in terms of diapering of babies.
Well, please tell me more.
Because radio reaches people, including those hard-to-get young people. Radio goes where they go and talks their language, recognizing the importance of contemporary sound.
And the sounds are instantly recognizable as belonging to the in-groups currently on top of the charts.
CITR, 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
It's wild.
Don't worry. touched.